everybody, welcome to Sonic Talk, episode 794, recording today, Wednesday, the 20th of March, that's right, as we head into spring. I don't know where you are, but I've got daffodils, I've got the blossoms out on the by the car park. It's all very nice, urban blooms and all that sort of stuff. Nice to see all our friends in the chat room. Rusty and Choir, Tracker Jack, Wagyu's there as well, half god, half beast. A few familiar faces, the audio ang, nice to see you, Tim. Grace Griffin, was that Grace Griffin? Yes, nice to see Grace. Grace obviously played at the last EMOM. So yes, good. And I want to say thanks to Wagyu, of course, for moderating as he does and also sort of manning some of the back end that takes a bit of the load off my shoulders. Very much appreciated. I know he does it for a lot of other people as well, so thanks, Wagyu. Coming up on Sonic, I should probably do this stuff first. Coming up on Sonic, we're streaming on LinkedIn. This is a first. Well, not a first. We tried it last week. We're doing it again this week. Latest news. Dom's gear. The family are still obviously trying to kind of shift some of his studio gear. As you know, Dom Hawkins, great friend of the show, sadly passed away last year. Well, very, very dearly missed. We've promoted a little bit of it, and there's still some of his studio gear for sale because I think the family are kind of thinking about moving somewhere else and they need to kind of move on with their lives. But there's some really good stuff there, and I'm sure it'd be much appreciated if anybody wants to grab that. Here's a link to the spreadsheet. It should be a live spreadsheet, which will show... I think that's it. Is that right? I hope it is. Which will show the stuff that's live and available. So anyway, thank you. If you want to check that out, it'd be much appreciated. And also, what have we got coming up? Oh, yeah, we've got a Sonic Couture competition, which we're just starting to run, which is... let me see. I think I put that right. Yes, you win Sonic to the ACDR drum machine, which we covered in the last, I think earlier this year, and also a bunch of other plugins as well. It's running for a few weeks. So if you want to win any of that stuff, there should be. It doesn't look like that bit.ly link. There's links on the site. There's a news item on the site, but do check that out. It's there's a bunch of free stuff available for you there. And also, what was the other thing I was going to say? Was there more coming up? Yeah, that's it. I think we're there. Indeed. Almost slick. I was just saying before the pre-show that I was having much less technical issues. I've just realised I forgot to update the live stream YouTube ID feed, which now should be sorted. So hopefully that'll work. We'll see. Anyway, let's get on to some guests. Let's start in Brighton or thereabouts with Steve Hillier. Steve Hillier, of course, Hi. Producer, DJ, educator, Dubstar member, founder member, producer, songwriter, and lots of other things. And fan of Helvetica. That looks like a new poster.
Yeah, it's a poster that comes from a movie that I think was made, I think about 20 years ago now, about the history of the font Helvetica, which is, it's really interesting. And of course, once you recognize Helvetica and spot its shapes, it's everywhere from the New York subway through to, you know, record covers. And it looks like maybe even on my shoegaze t-shirt that I'm wearing right now, which I didn't intend. I wasn't doing like a kind of font symmetry thing here, but there you go. In fact, it does look a little bit self-conscious, but no, there we go. Helvetica, everyone's friend.
How are you anyway? What's been going on in the world of Hillier recently?
Yeah, good, thanks. Got back from Paris on Monday. I was down there, I did a little party on the Friday night, and then on the Saturday, me and my partner Claire, we went to the Mark Rothko exhibition, which is in a big park in the Louis Vuitton center. It's like an art center, and just immersed ourselves in the world of, I suppose, mid-20th century abstract art, and it was absolutely extraordinary. You could the exhibition took you through the various different eras in his work, and then you landed, of course, with the work that he made just a few days before sadly he died by his own hand. And it's a beautiful thing, and I really, whenever I go away to a city, I try and make sure that I spend some time in art galleries, and particularly 20th century or modern art galleries. It's the sort of thing that interests me, because it's just so nice to just look at art and just think about art. It takes your mind to places that you just don't normally go to. So I would recommend, if I'm not sure how much longer the exhibition is on, but if you're in Paris, go and have a look at Mark Rothko. It was extraordinary.
Nice. I can thoroughly agree with that. We went to Birmingham recently and I saw the, it was the arts and crafts, the pre-Raphaelite arts movement, which I always thought was exactly that, you know, pre-Raphael, so quite old, but it's actually not at all. It's late 18th century, so or early 18th, no, late 1860s, 1840s, something around 1890s. And that was really good. Just a big surprise. But yeah, art is great. Nick Howes, Comic Sans till I die, he says. Yes, well... No accounting for taste, is there? Anyway, over to our friend Yoad Nivo, who's there in Nivo Sound, where he mans the controls for his productions and sample libraries, songwriting, Atmos mixes, all that stuff. How are you doing, Yoad?
Yeah, not too bad. It's been a while. I feel like I haven't been on for ages. I don't know. It's been like over a month, I think, or a couple of months. We kept missing each other. By the way, I missed you on Synth Expo on Sunday. I was there. Were you there on Sunday or Saturday?
I was there both days, but I went. I left about midday because
I arrived just after you, I guess. Was nice. Yeah, I was very much aware of the COVID risk there for some reason. It was quite confined and, you know.
Yeah, not very drafty.
No, not very drafty. But I mean, it's the sort of thing that kind of people who like to tweak knobs in the dark and fiddle feel kind of at home in. It was nice. And the pedal show as well. So many pedals, so many guitar stomp boxes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was quite comedic because I spent most of the time in the synth room. There were two rooms. It was great, organized by a chap called Paolo at Synth Expo, I think, if you follow their stuff. I had a really good time at that show. I spent most of the time in the synth room and I went into the pedal room at one point. I thought, I'll do some filming in here. But because they asked people to bring their own guitars, it was literally like a comedy show of lots of people walking around in a confined space with planks. You know, it was just like turning suddenly with kind of, it was, you know, the only way you could get through is wear it on your back. But if you were holding it in any way, you would just be doing this the whole time. And it was just, it was really amusing, actually.
I have to say that I found myself more interested in people's guitars than the actual stuff on display. Mostly. There was some nice guitars there. I got to play the Osmos for the first time. And I think I saved myself a couple of grand.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, because I really wanted to get it, but I was somewhat, I wouldn't say disappointed. It's great. And the kind of it's much more like kind of tactile than the Hydrosynth in terms of polyphonic aftertouch and all that. But I don't know. There was something about it which didn't kind of attract me to spend the price, you know, the money.
Interesting.
Which is a good thing because I do have the same engine on the Continuum Mini, and kind of, although it's being two voice. But the thing is that I think that what I missed mostly about the Osmos is the slide or the lack of it.
Mm.
The kind of, you know, gliding fretless thing, which I love about this. But I think that we're going to see more and more keyboards with.
Yeah, I think there's going to be more from them as well. I imagine there's more stuff coming from them, to be honest. I mean, I think you can't invest that much money in a new technology and not have a roadmap for other stuff coming. I mean, there must be.
I think that if they had a smaller kind of a 2-octave or 2.5 octaves, that will be more suitable for me because I don't need that many. The thing is, if you play kind of piano parts, then you wouldn't necessarily need that or those capabilities. And if you want to really be kind of MPing, then you don't need the the five octaves or whatever. So yeah, but it was a nice experience. And the engine, I love this engine. I love this synth. And they made it kind of more accessible, more tweakable than this monster with the software, which is just
it's an abject lesson in how not to design software for anybody to use. I understand the limitations of Max MSP. That was the only thing that's available, but it's left to a bit of a kind of like a cul-de-sac of usability, shall we say, assuming you can even get it working.
I'm very sensitive to those things because I'm a kind of UI person developer in my sort of day job. Exactly. All of it is my day job, but one of the hats I wear is obviously software design and plugin design. So I'm very much aware of things that are kind of not slick, shall we say.
Yeah, I totally get that. Anyway, we do have topics. There is stuff to talk about, one of which will be, we'll come back to the Synth Expo, just because we filmed a few things there. In fact, I do encourage you to check that. We did about 13 or so videos, which was great. Another triumph for our show workflow. It was all great. One thing that I will say, being given access to fast network makes all the difference to people like us for covering that sort of thing. So if you're listening out there and putting on an event, yes, please, we'll have more of that just for us, just so we can upload the stuff. And it will all happen really quickly. I realise that's very selfish of me. Okay, well, let's get on to the first of our topics. And this one is, I'm trying to figure out if I can actually make this work without playing the video. Let me see if I can do that. I don't think I can. I probably can. So if I do this, oh no, it's not.
Well, this is weird.
This is weird. This one. This is the one. In a world of waves and oscillations. This is the Sumo AI. There's a modulation that inspires sensations. The pulse which changes the timbre blues. We might appreciate subject matter if I sounds like the lovers too. Till you get to the chorus. Pulse with modulation, you send my heart aglow with your elegant fluctuations. You make the music flow. Pulse with modulation, a symphony of control in the realm of electronic dreams. You touch my soul. Oh, God, I've started to get a bit of a sweat on there. It's like I wrote a song and I'm playing it to people and everything. But, of course, that's not anything I actually penned. I typed in electronic ballad about pulse width modulation. That was it, really. And that's what it came up with, which musically is horrifically horrible and all of those things. But it's the new Suno.ai, which is kind of doing the rounds at the moment. And everybody's getting a bit freaked out by it because it is, while it's not... You know, it doesn't have, I mean, that particular genre. I'm sure there are other genres which it could probably do differently, whatever. But there is a convincingness to it. Whether or not you like it or not is another matter. I don't like it. I thought the music was horrible. But what I found very, very interesting about this was the way it wrote lyrics and then phrased those lyrics over the music it wrote. I thought that actually... If it wrote some lyrics that I was used for, because I'm not a singer, I don't know how I would phrase things. And I thought that part was actually quite interesting and perhaps something that I might utilise myself. But this is more of a kind of like Suno AI discuss thing, but that's my song about pulse width modulation, which I think I might release. Well, we can get onto that later, but I don't know. This is really interesting because you guys are both songwriters and I imagine this is quite a difficult topic really in many ways because not only is it, it's not the fact that it's out there, it's the fact that everybody is hearing it, so therefore it might become an accepted norm, rather than it's getting, I don't think it does a better job than most songwriters with any sort of ability whatsoever. It's just that people might accept it as okay. I don't know. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I think before I say go any further, I think I should just tell everyone that I am very pro AI. I use AI tools all the time. And so anything that I might say on this topic, I want that to be the context. You know, I've got nothing in itself against AI. And also, before coming on the show, I always just make a few notes, and I've got like absolutely shed loads to say, but which I won't go through because I'll end up sounding like an old man shouting at clouds or shouting at computers in this case. Nick, to go to your question, will tools like this make music like this seem acceptable? I'm reminded of my earliest experiences in the world of professional writing. And when I say professional writing, what I mean is when you're a writer for hire and you write for other people, typically for pop acts. So it's not like you're writing for your own band, you're writing for somebody else's band. And one of the things that I noticed very quickly was you would end up working with a lot of very skillful writers, and they would be able to turn out technically perfect songs day in and day out. In fact, that's sometimes what the job requires. But actually, it was quite rare that these people would write a song that would be emotionally engaging and take you from a place of, oh yeah, that sounds convincing, to a place of, wow, that's excellent. And that's what this tool reminds me of. You were talking there about how it can generate a lyric and it can mold the lyric and the melody together so it flows quite well. Yeah, it does do that. But to my ears, it's not taking me anywhere interesting. It's essentially just sounding technically proficient. I really do think that what actually engages people often is the imperfections or at least the unpredictable things that come from great artistry or inspiration or insight and that kind of thing. But that's not what this AI, at least at this point, is giving us. It's giving a whole load of convincing, which might not actually be sufficient. So what I would suggest, just to go around and answer your question, and I'll let Yoad speak, is I think that one of the problems with this tool is that it will create an abundance of a style of music and a style of writing that is already in abundance. Do you know what I mean? So there's plenty of kind of songs that are technically proficient but don't move you. And now this tool can generate 10 a minute, let's say. So you would have, through using this tool, you were reducing the economic value of this style of music down to near zero because you've got an abundance of it. Anyone can do it at any point. What I would hope will happen instead is that we will become more sensitive to the human input and the human imperfections and the human sense of serendipity and inspiration. And hopefully that will mean that stuff will become even more valued. I suppose it's highly valued now. Maybe that's not entirely what I mean. But I don't think this stuff is going to swamp people.
Recognized, perhaps, yeah. It is really interesting. I mean, I don't know, Yoad. I mean, in many ways, I did two versions. The first version I did had a male vocal, and the male vocal was much more robotic sounding. And I think I have a theory about why this was, and I think it's because female pop vocals are generally more highly processed, and we're trained to hear that, and it's through choice, you know. It's a thing, you know, it's a thing that we come to hear, and the way that the pitch tracking and everything is designed to work. So it sounded much more convincing in that way. But I don't know, this is an interesting, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, because songwriting is often a moment of brilliance. I mean, this thing, right, just before I get you go, so the way that they price this, you get it for free, you get 50 credits, which will give you, I don't know, 10 or 20 songs or something, I'm not exactly sure. You pay $8 a month and you get enough credits for 500 songs a month. $24 a month, 2,000 songs a month. So this is giving, and then there's another tier which says, talk to us if you want more. And I'm just sort of thinking, why would you want to generate that much stuff? You know, it's sort of, what's the, and I can only assume it's for inspiration to start you off, maybe, rather than anything else.
It could be for many different applications. I want to echo what Steve said, because I also have nothing against AI as such. And in fact, all the products I'm involved in creating and have been in the past couple of years have been AI and neural network related. By the way, we got another tech award for D-Reverb.
Nice.
This in January. Yeah, I wasn't. That means that I wasn't on the show. I haven't been on the show since, and that's on top of the Emmy from last year, which both are neural network kind of products.
Right.
And so, you know, I use it all the time, and I develop products that use AI and neural networks all the time, because it seems like it's everywhere, and this is a technology that we utilize for the pro audio, not in such way, because this is probably, you know, B2C, but like you said, it could be used by professionals to for inspiration, even maybe for more than that. The thing I would like to relate to comment about, which is not the songwriting. The songwriting is very skillful. It does what it needs to do. You know, I can hum kind of the melody of your song in my head, which means that it kind of ticks all the boxes of being catchy, being this. I may not like it, but it's definitely effective. And like you said, the phrasing and the lyrics, it works well. It's very professional. What I want to talk about is the kind of sound and quality, which is what you mentioned about the vocal quality, but I think it's more than that. I think that if you look at the content that this model has been trained on, so if you think about ChatGPT, if you think about Sora, if you think about Midjourney, those are platforms that utilize text and images and videos, but images for frame by frame. And the internet is abundant with that type of information. And more than that, when you think about language and text, there are some, everything is text, so you get loads of information, but also you have text about learning languages and grammar and poetry and all that. So you have the stuff that explains the stuff. Whereas in music, if I'm trying to make a parallel here, you don't get multi-tracks. You don't get separate tracks. You get loads of MP3s. Mm. You get loads of songs. Not as many as videos, because, okay, you have YouTube music or music on YouTube, but I don't think that Suno had access to the Spotify catalog or to SoundCloud or things like that. But even if they did, it's stereo tracks. So when you try to replicate an oboe or an electric guitar, it's not, you can't compare it to trying to replicate a kitten in a visual medium, because you have, oh, here is my cat. So you have a text description on every picture, nearly every picture, and there are billions of them, of a cat. So the model can train and compare it to the text. Whereas if you have a song that says Yellow Submarine by the Beatles, what does that description tell you about the song? Nothing. In it only confuses you. It only confuses the model, because it's not descriptive of what's inside the music, the content of the music. And on top of that, the fact that you don't have multi-track, you don't have separate tracks, so it means that the models are very poorly trained, as opposed to other mediums like text and images. So we're lagging behind in the audio format or medium, which maybe is a good thing, but that's the fact currently. So I can hear a lot. Like if you see a video, an amazing video on Sora or something, but the people there have eight fingers, it's fine. You'll still enjoy the video. But what would be the equivalent of that in audio? Will it be distortion? Will it be kind of beat crushing effect? Will it be the wrong chord? What would be? So our ears, our brain is much more sensitive and alert to continuity. With the video, you can reduce the frame rate and it's still fine. In pictures, you can compress it, JPEG, and it's still fine. In music, it has to be consistent over time. It has to be, your ears are very, or your brain is very sensitive to any kind of discrepancies. And so anything that would not make sense would stick out enormously.
Yes.
So these are things to consider. And that's why I think that the quality of music, of generated music, is not on par with video and text.
Right, it's interesting. There are so many questions, aren't there, Steve? I mean, that's a great description there by Yoad, though, of the difference.
Yeah, I wanted to just build on something that Yoad touched on. I was actually using this AI earlier this week. Somebody else had mentioned it and I had a go and I found it kind of interesting. But what struck me very, very quickly was that the interface with the AI was text, in the same way that you would give a prompt to Midjourney or you give a prompt to ChatGPT. And as Yoad said, if you're using text to generate text, that makes sense. If you're using descriptive terms to describe an image and you get an image back, that makes sense. But music is very hard to describe. No wonder the model gets confused, but also the human beings do. You know, if you've ever been in a meeting with an A&R person, it often feels that the musicians and the producer and the A&R person are all speaking different languages. So what I would hope is that the way that these tools are going to progress is that rather than using really quite almost infantile language to generate content, we can interact with it using the language that we already know as musicians, which is playing or manuscript or just a much more useful interface with this kind of content generation.
That's interesting. I wonder, you know, you could imagine this would be useful if I, you know, because I literally wrote an electronic ballad about PWM, right, for a laugh. I thought it's going to be, you know, whatever. There are certain genres which are more amusing, but there are things that I'm not sure about. Who is this for? I saw a couple of alternatives, you know, in the same way that you have hit factories, you know, which are, okay, there's a room full of songwriters. Yeah, we'll take that one further. I could get my $24 thing, generate 2000 verse chorus sections, give it to a bunch of bedroom producers and say, okay, 10 of those or maybe 100 of those are worth working on. Work them up, you know, maybe get a vocal recorder, whatever you do. Maybe one of those would become something that would go somewhere. Okay, very edge case use. I mean, you know, how many people in the world are going to want to do that? There might be a bunch of people. There might be, you know, for your $8 a month, I might sign up for 2 or 3 months, forget about my, just because it's a novelty and I like the idea that I can write some songs and give them to my mates. And I'm not a musician.
Have you looked at the royalties situation on that? Because I haven't. Can you claim the rights on PRS as if it you wrote the song?
The licensing, as I understand it, if you're not paying anything, it's theirs. If you're paying them a monthly fee, while you're paying the monthly fee, then you have the license to exploit it in any way you see fit. This is a very cursory glance. But if I lapsed, say I'd forgotten to pay for a month, you know, there is a possibility somewhere down the line. So I'm thinking maybe it's a rights grab. That's a possibility. So I don't think that could work, because you couldn't possibly do this and then find you're suing people. Because again, that model is like there might be 10 people a year who have a hit with something that started life there, and you know, maybe they forgot to renew their subscription, their card changed or whatever, and then you go after. That's not really a business model. It feels like this business model is designed to generate a whole bunch of people on the mailing list, a bunch of subscriptions, and then maybe tail off, and that'll be enough to kind of make it do a thing. I can't understand why you would. If I'm a filmmaker, or I'm doing writing, I need music for media or adverts or any of that kind of stuff. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe it was worth doing then. So maybe an age. But again, these are very tiny, tiny niches. And if I've got 2,000 a month for $24, it's not really a sustainable model. How many ad agencies are there in the world? You know, it doesn't make sense to me how it's going to be.
No, and also the wider world of commerce is very wary of this kind of stuff. I can tell you anecdotally, unfortunately, I can't use any names here, but there was a friend of mine who makes what we would call library music or production music. So basically music that's fit to movies and television things. And he has recently redone his publishing deal, and it's stipulated within his publishing deal that he may not submit anything that has been created using AI, as in generative AI, so the tool that we're talking about right here. Yeah, and also just in another hat that I wear in the company that I work with my wife, we've had to adopt a policy where when it comes to delivering images to a client, we simply can't risk using AI generated images, because the copyright situation is unclear and it's too risky. So living in a world where you can generate a whole lot of songs with this AI, but ultimately these songs belong to the company Soma, but you have to pay an ongoing license fee. You can see how this is going to become, how can I put it? I'm going to just say troublesome legally. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. It's a gamble, isn't it? It's definitely a gamble.
Yeah.
I get.
Yeah, I think I've just realized.
I mean, I knew. Right. Sorry, Yoad. I'll come back to you now. That was. But yeah, this is endlessly fascinating. I mean, there are so many things about this that are going to be problematic or challenging, shall we say?
Absolutely, and like Steve said, myself as a professional, I can't risk while this whole thing is in debate or in the making, or all the legislation and all that. I can't risk using something like that professionally, even if it's the lyrics, possibly, to later in 10 years or something to get it pulled off and to get to having to compensate some writers that the model has been trained on their content something like that. Yeah, so, but I think that their model, and I think you're right about that, kind of a business model. It's B2C. It's a numbers game. They get a tenner a month. They get another tenner. Another. They get 10,000 of that. That's $1 million a month. You know. So that's enough to run. To start, and then they can look at licensing to bigger companies with which they can make specific deals. So it's less vague and kind of more tailored legally to the needs of who knows who or what. But the thing is that there are so many vendors of generative AI out there that you want to establish your position in the market to begin with. So even if you're losing money in the first year then you get a foothold in that market you know, so it's a brand building and all that business stuff.
Right, I'm going to move things along a little bit, just because we have spent quite a lot of time on this, and I think the natives are getting a little restless. I do apologise for cutting you off there, Steve. We should probably talk about synths and stuff, right? So basically, I think we'll go to this one, because this is going to be, I think, I sent this topic out and everybody pretty much had warm words to say about this whole area. So let's start
in today's
video.
We're going to take a look at the Yamaha FB01 from 1986.
Espen Kraft, Yamaha MT32 versus FB01, both early multi-timbral
instruments. Both these modules came at a time where the amateur musician with not so much money in his pocket really wanted a multi-timbral sound module to work with his sequencer and maybe out on a gig. And
right, that let me switch to this because there's also a great video from let me see, where did I put it? I think five. This is a piece by Paulie, didn't make it this one, but they put together 10 years or so ago, as when they're as the artist Elmo Sex Whistle, a whole kind of, it's almost like a rock opera using the M32. This is part of it. So I just remember all of that stuff. I mean, the M32, later the D110, was my weapon of choice. Just the empowerment it gave me to be able to do 8 channels plus drums of multi-timbral synthness was astonishing. So for me, M32/D110 all day long. I don't know about you, Steve. I mean, you probably, like me, started those early Roland multi-timbral units were such enablers for people, you know, because we didn't need tape. We could actually run it all from a computer or a sequencer. It was just, it's hard to overestimate how important they were, I think.
It was a dream come true. The idea that you could make an arrangement that wasn't dependent on, in my case, moving cassette tape around. Do you know what I mean? So you could actually set up stuff in. I was using an Atari ST, which was brilliant for lots of reasons. And so having a multi-timbral synth, or actually, I'd started not with either of these units, but with samplers. I suppose it's from sort of growing up as a DJ and that kind of thing. So sampling and hip hop was my interest. So having multi-timbrality was a real eye opener. And I mean, if you compare it to where we are now, it's sort of laughably restricting. But in some ways, that was the gave you some of the nuances of the music that came out in that time, in the late 80s and early 90s. There's a particular sound to it that inevitably came from the restrictions that these instruments had. I must say, though, I was tempted back in the day to get a Yamaha FB01, and I tried one out because it was the multi-timbrality that really interested me. But what I noticed, and again, I say this as somebody who lives and breathes FM. That's my preferred style of synthesis. But what I noticed was that you really have to know what you're doing when you start layering up FM sounds, because they seem to just sort of mush together and you end up with a sort of, you're not growing, what your sound is not
sea
really
of sine
growing.
Waves.
Yeah, it's not growing. It's not moving any better, and it's not getting any bigger. It's just sort of becoming more. It's a bit like when you were at school and you were mixing paints together. You think, oh, what's blue and red like? Oh, it's kind of purple. Well, let's add some orange, and eventually you end up with a dark grey. That's what it sort of felt like with layering FM. And I wasn't good enough at programming to use an FB01 for that. Although I could do it now, I suppose. But it was exciting times. And of course, the MT32 gave you pretty much the entire sound of almost the entire sound of the D50, which was the holy grail for teenagers with no money in the late 80s.
That's very true. Interesting. The M32 is a motorway out of Bristol. The MT32 was introduced, I think it was $695, which is equivalent to about 1800 in today's money, which is kind of interesting. But back then, I remember it was a budget. I remember seeing it. I think the reason I went D110 because it had multi outputs and the idea of being able to process, because you could then do all the drums and kick and snare and stuff out and bust things out. There is as much multi-timbrality these days in this true sense of the word. I mean, we see it in workstations, but
you don't need it anymore. My first venture into multi-timbral stuff was the Kawai K5M, which did have four outputs and 15 parts multi-timbral, additive synthesis, and I learned a lot about synthesis from using that. And then when the that was a kind of a poor man's D50, because it could do those fantasy belly sort of sounds with a pad, because it was just, but it wasn't the real thing. And then when the MT32 came out, it was amazing. I couldn't afford the D110. I went for the MT32, which, and I did a lot of stuff with it. And actually I started learning about programming and about stuff like that because of the limitations of the MT32, because it wouldn't save. It didn't have a kind of RAM thing. So once you turned it off, it would go back to its initial default state.
It had the Roland stuff had a SysX edit buffers though, didn't they? So you just dumped the pad,
exactly. Right? So I started learning to program in hexadecimal and in C-Lab, which is the predecessor of Logic on the Atari ST. You could have meta events in the grid editor. So I used to type commands in SysX, which would translate to in a hexadecimal, which would translate to SysX, so I could change the reverb and change a bunch of stuff on there, so it would load with my song, and then it would send the kind of data before the song starts, and then I would be. But then later on, I had an editor from Steinberg, which was mind-blowing, and it was multitasking as well on the Atari, because you can run it alongside C-Lab. And that opened up everything in a graphic way, so you could assign the different channels all to channel one. So I had like 8 parts playing, and I loved the pulse width thing and the kind of sawtooth and pulse oscillators, which are so shitty, but there was something at the time, you know, that's what I had, but there was so they had so much grit and so much artifacts and kind of but I did like patches where I used the 8 parts, each one of them had 4 oscillators, so like 32 oscillators detuned and with pulse width modulation, and creating like mega sounds with the M32. I still have it here. I hope the battery, I haven't powered it on for decades. I hope the battery hasn't destroyed it or something. And in comparison to the FB01, which I also have, but I bought it much later when it was kind of retro and I wanted to get the bass sound, you know, the kind of UK bass sound out of that. But at the time, to do the pan flute and to do those horrid pianos, that wasn't, no, I hated that. Also, in terms of the configuration, you could do either, it had 8 voices, so you could either do 8, you had to configure it, so you had to do either 8 parts, 8 monophonic parts, or 2 and 6, or 3 and 3, or something like that. It would never let you do kind of what you wanted to do.
The MT wins. Yeah, I think we've got 3 for the MT here. The chat room can decide what they. I think because I remember this D110. I remember that now. That because what you would do, the D110 had, you know, I've said this before. The manual was like this thick, and about this much of it was SysX MIDI specification. Yes. So I remember I would do the same thing. So I would program the stuff up, but rather than save things, because the patch memory in Roland's was awful, because you'd have to save the tones, then you'd have to save the timbres, then you'd have to save the setup, and it was just like, oh, but if you just pressed enter, if you jumped out right to the top level and just press enter, it would dump the whole lot of the current patch as a SysX dump, and so that's what I would do. I would just have the first 2 bars would be the SysX dump, and then then the song would start, and then you could run the whole thing. But the D110, I mean, that's the bass sound for Tom's Diner, the D110. I mean, believe it or not, I mean, it's bizarre. But and there's, I'm sure I used it all over the place. I've still got it. I think that I did talk to Milo Melodies at the weekend, and he sort of doorstepped me saying, okay, what's the synth you would never sell? And I should have said D110, because I owe so much to it, because I learned so much from it. But I do remember that, again, you'd have to assign polyphony to each part. It wasn't that straightforward. And so, you know, by the time you got to, so you go, oh, I have to decrease six from there. That means I can add two to that one and one to this one. And then two, it was quite clunky, but it was extremely, extremely powerful for the time, I think. You know, it's just an absolute classic. Sorry, Steve, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but it was so fascinating, that first topic. We could have made the whole show about it quite easily.
Oh, you know, the amount of Friday nights in the pub that I've spent discussing AI. what I was going to mention was there was a very special moment for me when I discovered that my Casio CZ-101, remember those?
Was four parts.
Was multi-timbral. Yeah. It was amazing. Unfortunately, that amazement didn't last very long, when I realized that if you just started throwing, you know, multiple MIDI messages on multiple channels down into this machine, the timing just went. It wasn't useless, but you're not going to be putting it on any dance records. Let's put it like that. It seems to be like the bane of my life in the late 80s, when I was really starting in this world, was beautiful sounding synthesizers with really rubbish CPUs that just couldn't keep up with me and my Atari. So there you go.
Well, the trick was, this is what I remember doing, is you would start track one, you put your low MIDI channels at the top of the arrangement page, and your kick drum on track one, because that would leave the building first and have prioritize, and you would have to kind of actually...
Yeah.
Pro 24 or whatever it was, or Cubase at all.
Yeah, and another trick that you would have to do was, when it came to the kick, is that you would... put it one click ahead of the beat, so that it had, so it was essentially, if you can imagine a four to the floor beat, your first kick would happen right at the very end of the previous bar, so it had the highest priority, and it wasn't competing for bandwidth within the MIDI stream, if you know what I mean, because rather than you would tend to have three or four, maybe more things all happening on beat one, bar one.
Oh, well, gosh, that's so funny.
Do you see what I mean? So that the kick would get priority.
Yeah, because house tracks would always have piano chords on the one. And I also remember I would do the opposite. I would keep the kick on bar one, but then I would tick the every chord. I'd go in and I'd move it forward one tick, so that it would be kick and then in tick, so you wouldn't hear it. So every single chord would have you'd quantize it, and then you'd go in and change each note so they didn't hit all at the same time, so it didn't affect the drums. Gosh, I saw you smiling there, Johan. Gosh,
those were fun days, but I kind of miss it, because now there are no limitations, and limitations lead to creativity. You know, you try to find ways, and those ways lead to happy accidents. And these days even if you run out of CPU, then you freeze your tracks or whatever, or bounce them, or bounce in place, or whatever, or get an AI to do the whole thing for you. So it's a little bit boring in that sense.
Wow, if you could have got an AI to offset all your chords by one tick, that would have been really handy back in the day, wouldn't it?
Oh, man.
Because that was pretty tedious. That was tedious work for sure. Have you guys got time for another topic? I would really wanted to talk about the Visco morphing drum machine. I thought it was kind of really interesting UI business. Is that okay for you folks?
Go for it.
Yes, okay. I'll press the button. Oops. I'll press the button. Yeah, Visco Morphing Drum Machine. This is from a couple of ex-Teenage Engineering and Ableton veterans. Sampling manipulation, but using this really interesting UI, which is, they call it the Blob. And it allows you to automate and record. It's sort of like an advantage, not an advance, an advance in the XY manipulation axes, I suppose. And obviously it's messing with kind of transients. It's really interesting. What can it do? Eight voice drum engine, toolbox, character and shape with the blob for morphing sounds. €99 intro from 139 comes with drum sounds, I'm assuming. Did I see what that said? I can probably catch that number. Interesting. I'm going to come to you first, Yoav, because you're a software and UI guy. I mean, it looks gimmicky, but actually it seems like it might be quite intuitive to use.
Yeah, I think the blob, first of all, great sounds. I really like the concept. I really like the morphing capabilities. The blob thing is kind of an eye candy because it's just an XY pen. So you could do without it in terms of usability. I don't think it informs you of anything, but still, it looks great and it kind of makes you feel, you know, important. I think that it's based on kind of form of additive synthesis in the way that it kind of gets the imprint of the harmonics of a given sample and then recreates it using noise and bins and FFT bins, which to me sounds like there's an inherent sort of lack of punch. So all the sounds I heard are a little bit smeared in the attack. And I think maybe I'll get in touch with these guys because I like this product, or they can get in touch with me because I think I have a few ideas about how to go about that and to make it more punchy. But really, really cool, really cool. And especially if you kind of want to create sample libraries and have different or round robins for that matter for live, then it can be very, very, I don't know if they have kind of a randomness aspect in their modulation, or you can probably use sample and hold or something to modulate some of the parameters so each hit will sound slightly different in some parameters. I don't know how it can cope with acoustic because they have like a jazz example and things, and it sounds still a little bit kind of drum machine-y. So I'm not sure if the resolution, the number of bins that they use, because the more bins you use, the less punchy. So there's a trade-off here in the implementation of the technology. So I'm not sure how precise and accurate it will be recreating proper acoustic sounds and in stereo. Absolutely. and all that. But as a drum machine, it's great. Really cool product.
Excellent. That's from Forever 89, by the way. I forgot to, neglected to mention that. Steve, we often have drum based products on here because, I mean, you know, as we know, it can be a very tedious process, even just managing your own drum library, let alone figuring out which hi-hat to use. Something like this maybe can kind of make that a little bit easier or different, I suppose, right?
Yeah. I've lost many hours with those hi-hats. You know, I'm not familiar with this product. So this is the first I've seen of it was what we've just heard. But when you mentioned about the beauty of its user interface, it made me think of something that I've been doing quite recently. I treated myself around Christmas time to one of these, which is a Nord Drum 3P. So essentially what this is, it's six trigger pads, and it's got six synthesizers inside, which give you drum sounds. And the reason I got this was that I realized that I really felt that I needed to move away from creating drum parts that were just me writing notes on a grid. And so instead, now, the interface that I use for creating drum parts is actually me hitting this with sticks. And it's been a revelation. It's I'm not much of a drummer, But I have noticed that my drum parts now are more fluid. They feel a little bit more musical. They're certainly more satisfying to me. And then also the because of the nature and design of the synthesizer in the Nord Drum 3P, every hit is slightly different. So it feels different than if you were using a sample, which is what I would tend to do,
right.
or even if it's a sample of a synth, which is my usual workflow. So it's got it has more life in it, I think is how I would put it. So the patterns are more lively and the sounds are more lively. So I would thoroughly recommend it. It's a really nice machine.
Interesting. I admire your the fact that you got, because I remember doing this. I remember I bought a Roland Hansonic for the same reason, because I was getting a bit sick of programming everything via a keyboard, and I thought if I at least tap things. And the thing is, the revelation I found was that I'm so bad at playing stuff in time that I'm doing it and I go, this feels great. And then I listen back to go, that's not what I played. Surely it can't be that bad.
No.
And I'm pretty sure it wasn't just MIDI sort of delay. It was actually, no, I'm really not very good at playing.
I was reminded playing this that actually, if you want to be good at an instrument, you have to practice, which is something I kind of forgotten with all the quantize and auto tune and compressors and AI that we have now. If you're going out back into this physical world, it's time to get practicing, guys, like you're 9 years old with your first piano lesson.
Yeah, well, that's true. Wagyu's just popped this. The Korg Wave Drum seems to be a sound. Wave Drum was and is a pretty amazing physical modeling synthesizer with piezo pickups and microphones in it. The problem that that Korg had with the Wave Drum, I would put forward, is there was no external interfacing. You could not send MIDI out. The only way you could record performances is by playing, which is not a bad kind of idea. I mean, but just the fact that they wouldn't give you that. I think there were so many. It's like we've seen with some MPE instruments and the Harkins as well. The resolution is so high for the performance parameters that, you know, MIDI just couldn't handle getting it and playing it back. So it's an interesting, it sounded amazing, the Wave Drum. I think a big shout out for that, and the Wave Drum too. I think Andy reviewed those, and they were just brilliant. I think he bought one, kept one. There was different versions, that is a bit of a classic. But yeah, good point. But it is hard, right? It's hard playing drums. Do you go pads or are you mouse?
I use the keyboard. I love this. I love the micro nano, the nano keys for drums.
That's rough.
It's very, very low res. I have the Korg, you can't see it, but I have the Korg, the Minilog XD, which is nice. And you remember, because I asked you about it fits neatly in my desk. I like the feel of the machine studio thing. I really love the, and I have this thing, which I programmed to give me all the banks. We covered it ages ago. The pads are not great, but I find myself doing this. I have an Alesis kind of drum pad. It's horrible. No, I just do it like that. But I do play. I rarely kind of draw it on the screen, unless it's a sort of a step sequencing kind of, you know, when you 808 style. Thing.
I've been playing with this recently because we're going to be, I'm hoping to get round to a review. And I have to say, this is great fun to use for programming beats. It's actually, even though it looks like an old C64 calculator from a shop,
it does.
It's actually really fun to use and really kind of quite inspiring. I have to say, they've got. And partly because of these, you know, similar feel to the keys on your. They are actually, yeah. There is velocity on them. They're not. I don't know how many levels there are. They're also pressure, so you can record certain things. But it's it's a really, really interesting machine, I have to say. Hopefully, I'll get around to doing that review. It's been sort of on the desk. So I keep turning to it and go, few foibles. No chaining mode, which I think is a shame. But you can do a lot of patterns in it. Each, I think there's nine projects. Each project has 99 scenes. Each scene can have a different pattern in it, so you can create combinations and you switch scenes, but I don't think there's a way to sequence the scenes. There may be a way to do it via MIDI, which might help a bit. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, beat programming is always some people are just really distressingly good at it, and they can do it all with mice or just a pad, and just have got the groove, you know. And bless them for it. I'm happy for them, but sadly, I'm not one of them. Not anymore, anyway. I think I used to be, but those days are gone. So, folks, thank you so much for hanging in there and for sticking with us. I know we covered one topic more than many of the others, but much appreciated. Steve, it's a pleasure to have you on. What's next for you? You got more gigs? I guess it's getting spring. There must be lots of DJ stuff coming. The sap is rising and all that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mentioned it last time I was on. I've got a couple more low-key but new releases that are coming out. If people out there are interested in hearing what I do, go to the Dubstar Archive, which is on YouTube. Just search for Dubstar Archive and you'll find the stuff there. Or you can go to my website where I've got all the information. The first release will be on this Thursday, which I the Thursday before Easter, and then there's one the following day after, and then there's another one the following Friday. I've got quite a hectic schedule, but I've actually found the time to be creative and productive, so lucky me.
Nice, glad to hear it. And thank you for joining us. And you're also, Yad, I'm guessing you're going to alt tab into some massive Atmos mix or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. I know you've been very busy, and it's very pleased to be able to have you. Anything you can talk about? Any exciting stuff coming up?
Mixing some very cool tracks and working on development, which I can't disclose at this point, but some releases are coming soon. And yeah, I better not say anything. But yeah, I'm okay. Very busy. I'm very grateful to being able to do what I do, which is both mixing and production, but also developing very cool products. So yeah.
Absolutely. And I urge you to check out the videos we shot at the Synth... what's it called? The Synth Expo, Synth Pedal Expo that we did. Thanks again to Paolo and the team for putting on such a great event. The playlist is on YouTube and there's a few shorts up there as well. Yes, so great. Well, okay, that's it for this week. Thanks to everybody in the chat and thanks to all our live viewers. We'll see you next time. See you, folks. Take care now.